I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Unexplained, Season 5, Episode 5, When Love Breaks Down, Part 2. Please note the following episodes contain details of events that some may find disturbing and are not suitable for children. Things had been steadily sliding for Susan after the death of her mother from cancer when Susan was only 14. Though in truth, they'd been sliding for some time before that. Susan Atkins was born in 1948 in San Gabriel, California. With one older and one younger brother, her family moved a number of times as she was growing up, but were based mainly in San Jose. Superficially at least, to outsiders they seemed normal enough. Later, Susan would claim that as a young girl, she was sexually abused by a male relative, and that both her parents drank heavily. By 12 years old, she was shoplifting regularly. Having been brought up to believe in God, her parents' alcoholism and later her mother's painful and premature death left her angry and resentful that any God would sanction such things. Being left to effectively take over her mother's role in the home and having to watch her father drink himself into a drunken stupor every night only served to harden her sense of injustice. Before long, she would find herself secretly frequenting the bars on the quieter edges of town, seeking comfort in the alcohol and company she found there. Feeling increasingly restless and trapped by her predicament, her grades at school began to suffer, and after being told she would have to repeat her junior year, she made the decision not to go back and headed to San Francisco. Despite quickly picking up a job selling subscriptions to magazines, her employer neglected to give her a steady wage, and before long, she was struggling to pay her bills. But something else was beginning to bite. A deep and profound sense of loneliness. Something she was beginning to realize had dogged her whole life. One night, Susan attempted suicide by swallowing a bottle of codeine pills, claiming later that it was just a cry for help. Soon after, she met a guy, and together, along with a friend of his, they embarked on a road trip to Oregon for some business he had to attend to. The business turned out to be an unspecified heist of some sort. Rather than being disturbed by the revelation, what Susan felt most of all as they sped toward their destination was an intense sense of freedom and the sheer thrill of it. Not long into their journey, however, after holding up a number of gas stations, the group were caught by highway patrol officers on the lookout for their vehicle, which, unbeknownst to Susan, had been stolen. Susan was given 3 months in jail for her part in the operation and afterwards returned to San Jose. A month later, she was back in San Francisco, still searching for somewhere to belong. And then, she discovered lysergic acid diethylamide, also known as LSD. It is a mode of all new generations to examine and re-evaluate the world left to them by their forebears. For 1960s youth in the West, that was a world partly characterized by war and control. With its innate ability to unravel the mind, LSD provided the perfect tool to deconstruct this oppressive reality. Though hallucinogenic drugs were nothing new, having long been used by many ancient cultures throughout the world, the nature of LSD, a synthesized compound of lysergic acid invented in a lab in 1938, made it perfect for cheap mass production and consumption. Susan's first trip was a nightmare ride. Taking it in the company of the stranger she'd procured it from, all sense of the world around her quickly dissolved into wild kaleidoscopic patterns and explosions of color. But before long, all sense of herself began to dissolve too. As Susan battled the terror that she might lose herself forever, the stranger did what he could to reassure her, reminding her over and over again that she was still Susan and that she was not going to disappear. A few weeks after this experience, Susan fell in with Barbara and her commune on the corner of Oak and Lion Street. Though warmly accepted by the group, Susan continued to be plagued by that abject sense of loneliness until the day she met Charlie. After listening to him play guitar for the first time, the pair had spent the night together. A few days later, while sat on the curb in Haight-Ashbury, Charlie attempted to explain to her the importance of living in the now. To live in the now was to be cleansed of the baggage of the past and the expectations of the future. It was as pure a state as you could reach. And should you ever want for anything, he explained, all you have to do is think it, and it will be so. If you want a quarter, for example, just visualize a quarter. A moment later, Susan watched with utter amazement as a stranger approached, holding out a quarter, and placed it in Charlie's hand. When he asked her later that day to go with him to Los Angeles, it was as if he already knew what she was going to say. Sharon and Roman had returned to Los Angeles in early 1967 after Sharon was offered a part in an adaptation of the 1966 novel Valley of the Dolls, while Roman secured a three-picture agreement with Paramount Pictures in Hollywood. In August, Roman left for New York to begin principal photography on the first of these three films, an adaptation of the Ira Levin book, Rosemary's Baby. The film, now regarded as one of the finest psychological horror films of all time, follows the story of Rosemary and her husband Guy as they prepare for the birth of their first child. When their eccentric neighbors take an unusually keen interest, Rosemary becomes convinced they are part of a satanic coven, intent on stealing it. Without wanting to give too much away for those who haven't seen it, the tortured Rosemary isn't entirely wrong in her assumptions. At one point, Sharon was considered for the lead role of Rosemary, which was offered in the end to Mia Farrow. Though she was disappointed, 1967 was still set to be a big year for her, with no less than three movies due for release at the end of the year. Much to Sharon's further disappointment, however, all three films, The Fearless Vampire Killers, Eye of the Devil, and finally Valley of the Dolls, were poorly received both commercially and critically. The response left Sharon, who already felt insecure about her acting abilities, deeply despondent and questioning the state of her career prospects. Meanwhile, Roman was glowing after wrapping up Rosemary's Baby in December, convinced he'd captured something special. With Sharon turning her thoughts to settling down and perhaps having a baby of their own, the couple were married in January the following year and travelled back to Europe to spend their honeymoon. A few months previously, Susan, Charlie, and five other young women were speeding down Route 1 inside a black painted bus, heading toward Los Angeles. Halfway down, the group pulled over to admire the golden Californian coastline and dropped acid together. Doing it with Charlie was an altogether different experience from Susan's first time in San Francisco. Whereas before she'd resisted the assault on her sense of self, Charlie urged her to embrace it, telling her, "You must die to self in order to become one with the world." Arriving in LA later that day, the group settled in Topanga Canyon, an area of rugged country northwest of Santa Monica, and home to a slew of artists and musicians keen to escape the city. Over the next few months, living off the charity of others, their lives centered around LSD and marijuana, and the ceaseless teachings of Charlie, imploring them to shed all inhibitions and to forget about yesterday and tomorrow, and to live only in the eternal now. Sometimes it would be the odd lines uttered throughout the day. Other times, Charlie would give long, intense lectures to drive home his point, urging anyone willing to listen to throw off the shackles of the plastic world, even to reject all concept of time, since it too was just another meaningless construct. And whenever Susan threatened to dip into one of her familiar lows, whenever that sense of loneliness began knocking at the door, there was Charlie to remind her, "You are beautiful, you are perfect, and you must learn to love yourself." By the spring of 1968, the tide was already turning against the summer of love and the optimism of the flower power generation, as their dreams of bringing an expanded consciousness to the wider population was already beginning to fade. The war in Vietnam continued to drag on, and as the opposition to it became increasingly hostile, so too did the government's response to that opposition, metering out violent retribution to many who rallied and protested against it. In April 1968, after all the gains of the civil rights movement, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. was a brutal reminder of the segregationist attitudes that continued to underpin much of the nation. Then in June, presidential hopeful Robert Kennedy, a longtime supporter of civil rights, who also recognized the folly of persisting with the American Vietnam War, was also assassinated, effectively handing that year's presidential election to Richard Nixon. Sharon and Roman had dinner with Kennedy a few nights before he was murdered. A few days later, Roman received the distressing news that Christoph Commoder, who composed the score for Rosemary's Baby, had been involved in an altercation at a house party and fallen off the edge of the property. Commoder was knocked unconscious, sending him into a coma from which he would never wake up, dying 4 months later. Some noticed similarities with the accident and the fate of a character in Rosemary's Baby, leading some to suggest that perhaps the film was cursed. The couple's marriage was struggling too, not helped by the discovery one night by Sharon and her friends of a set of unmarked videotapes belonging to Roman. Putting one on out of curiosity, they watched with horror when it became clear that they were tapes of Roman having sex with another woman. Sharon turned increasingly to her ex-boyfriend Jay for support, with the pair having remained close since Sharon and Roman got together. It was that year also that Sharon began work on The Wrecking Crew, during which she was interviewed by Hollywood correspondent Dick Kleiner and reminded of that horrifying night she'd spent at Jay's house on Eastern Drive. Back in Topanga Canyon, Susan's new family was growing larger by the week to include a number of men to add to the six women that originally travelled to LA with Charlie. Sparn Ranch was the perfect solution. Nestled in the Santa Susana Mountains, just 15 kilometres to the north, the ranch, dressed up to look like an old Western film set, had previously been hired out by a number of films and TV shows. By 1968, however, much like the paint on the various outhouses dotted about the place, its glory days had long since faded, When Charlie approached ranch owner George Spahn, offering to look after the maintenance of the property in return for his group living there rent-free, Spahn, who was 80 years old at the time and almost completely blind, was more than happy to agree. That he was apparently offered occasional intimate time with some of the young women who would be living there only served to sweeten the deal. Shortly before arriving, Susan discovered she was pregnant. Fearing it might jeopardize her position in the group, she was relieved to find that Charlie was overjoyed at the prospect, insisting that children were the best of them since they were completely pure and uncorrupted by the plastic world. Likely due to her drug use, Susan gave birth 2 months premature in October. The baby, weighing only 2 pounds at the time, was named Zizozisi Zadfrak. Life at the ranch was a fairly languid affair, consisting mostly of the group sitting around, smoking pot, playing cards, and making love to each other. Everything was shared, from clothes to food, with dinner often involving the group sitting around a large pot of stew and rice and taking it in turns to eat from it. And throughout it all, Charlie continued his teachings. Then, in November, with the release of the Beatles' White Album, the teachings took a darker tone. With their new album, Charlie believed the Beatles were trying to communicate with him directly, and it was in one song in particular that their message was most abundantly clear. Helter Skelter, according to some, is a brilliantly frenetic, sexually charged blast of proto-heavy rock. To Charlie, however, it was nothing less than a coded prophecy signalling the oncoming of an apocalypse. Charlie had already begun discussing the potential for apocalypse prior to the album's release, putting his own spin on the stories contained in the Book of Revelations. At some point, Charlie, a confirmed white supremacist, became convinced that a race war was going to take place in America, whereby white Americans would fight each other over the treatment of black Americans. What was left of the white population would then be slaughtered by black militants. Charlie's plan was to find somewhere for their group to hide until it was over, after which they would emerge and subjugate the black population, since, according to him, they would be incapable of running the country. The Book of Revelations speaks of a bottomless pit from which the fifth angel, Abaddon, will release a plague of locusts onto the world. Charlie, who believed himself to be Abaddon, surmised that the group would have to find this bottomless pit in order to survive the apocalypse and fulfill his prophecy. Helter Skelter would quickly become Charlie's shorthand for this racist vision, and one that began increasingly to consume him, and in turn, seep into his followers. Do you ever have trouble sleeping? One especially spooky podcast keeping you up all night, perhaps? Do you ever worry that you aren't getting all the nutrients you need for your body to thrive? Athletic Greens is a great-tasting multivitamin and multimineral made from the most absorbable form of each ingredient that takes the guesswork out of knowing what to take or from where. What's more, Athletic Greens goes beyond the standard multivitamin by encompassing other nutrient categories to give you much more, helping to support gut health, energy, immunity, stress, and sleep. With as many as 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense formula on the market. I enjoy it because it tastes good and makes getting as much high-quality nutrition as possible incredibly easy. So if you're looking to upgrade your multivitamin or take one nutritional formula that's going to help your daily nutritional basis, then you want to consider Athletic Greens. Right now, Athletic Greens is also giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free liquid vitamin D supplement amounting to a one-year supply with your first purchase for additional immune support. Make an investment in your health today and try the ultimate all-in-one wellness bundle and support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/unexplained. That's athleticgreens.com/unexplained. In February 1969, Sharon fell pregnant, and with Patty Duke needing her home back, she decided with Roman to find somewhere a little more permanent to raise the baby. It was around this time that Sharon heard her friends Terry Melcher and Candice Bergen's house was going on the market. The house, located at 150 Cielo Drive in Benedict Canyon, was built in 1944 with previous residents including Cary Grant and Henry Fonda. Located at the furthest end of the road, the long, one-story house was surrounded by tall pines and cherry blossom, with a much-prized view overlooking the canyon, down across to Beverly Hills, and all the way to the sparkling waters of the Pacific Ocean, about 10 miles away. Sharon and Roman knew the place well, having attended numerous parties there before, and needed little convincing to take it off the market. Sharon was especially taken with the line of Christmas lights that former owner Candice had strung up across the front of the property, lending it a perennial air of festive spirit. Presently, it was occupied by a young man who'd been staying there temporarily, having been living previously with a group of hippies out on an old Western movie set called Spahn Ranch. In late February, Sharon and Roman signed the lease and promptly moved in before both taking jobs in Europe. While they were away, the couple offered the place to their friends Abigail Fulger and Wojciech Frykowski. In late March, the day before Susan was due to travel to Italy to begin work on her latest film, she invited her friend, photographer Shirok Hatami, to the property to take some publicity stills of her. Later that afternoon, they were joined for dinner by Jay, Wojtek, and Abigail. At some point, Shirok noticed a shortish-looking man with long dark hair and an intense look on his face, making his way across the front lawn. Moments later, the man drew up to the porch. Angered by the stranger's sudden appearance, Shirok went over to meet him and asked him what he was doing there. When the man said he was looking for Terry Melcher, Shirok informed him that he no longer lived there and promptly sent him on his way. As the man walked away, Sharon arrived suddenly to inquire who he was. "It's nobody," explained Shirok. "He's just looking for someone who isn't here." Aside from impending apocalypse, Charlie's other obsession was music, specifically becoming a verified recording artist in his own right. Convinced he was just as talented as any of the other bands clogging up the airwaves, he made numerous efforts during his time at Spahn Ranch to secure a record deal. At some point, Charlie had worked himself into the orbit of Beach Boy Dennis Wilson and spent many hours, accompanied by Susan and other members of the group, hanging at Wilson's house. Wilson was sufficiently impressed by Charlie's songwriting that he even appropriated one of his songs, called Cease to Exist, to use as a B-side on the Beach Boys single Bluebirds Over the Mountain, released in December 1968. Wilson recommended Charlie to his friend and producer, Terry Melcher, suggesting that he work with him on a few tracks. After spending a few sessions with him in the spring of 1969, however, Melcher was unconvinced of his talent. About the same time, Charlie was becoming more and more convinced of his own prophecies and moved the group to another ranch in Death Valley, the place where he believed they would find the bottomless pit that was going to save them from the end of the world. The group, now leaning increasingly on new arrival Tex, turned to dealing drugs in order to pay for the move. Tex, a former honors student and athlete, had been studying at the University of North Texas before he dropped out and found his way to Los Angeles and eventually Spahn Ranch. One night, Tex claimed he was ripped off in a drug deal with a man named Bernard Crow, prompting Charlie to drive out to Crow's home and shoot him. Returning to Spahn Ranch, it was clear something had shifted in him. He was convinced that Crow was a Black Panther and that the organization would come looking for retribution. In short, this was the beginning of the race war he had foreseen. Time was fast running out, and they would need money and protection to survive. Charlie ordered his followers to keep a knife on them at all times, and so began the creepy crawling. For Susan, it was nothing more than utilizing the shoplifting skills she had procured ever since she was 10 years old. And so it was that in the dead of night, or even in the middle of the day, she and the others began to tiptoe silently in bare feet into the homes of the rich and famous, armed with knives as they cautiously hunted for things to steal. Everything was justified because possession was just a state of mind. Nothing belonged to anyone, and nothing was real. And if they had to exist in a plastic world that they didn't choose, this was the only way to survive. The next step seemed almost inevitable. Gary Hinman had befriended Susan and the rest of the group during their time in Topanga Canyon. He'd even helped them out, often giving them food and money. It was late one afternoon when Charlie approached Susan and told her that if she wanted to do something important for the group and their mission, she should go to Gary's house and steal the $21,000 he'd recently inherited. And if she really wanted to prove her commitment to the mission, she should kill him too. That night, Susan, along with two other of Charlie's acolytes, Bobby and Mary, drove out to Topanga Canyon and demanded that Gary give them the money or suffer the consequences. But Gary refused, insisting that he didn't have the money. Taking the lead, Bobby pulled out a gun and tried to shoot him, only for Gary to fight back and eventually wrestle the gun away from Bobby. But Gary wasn't a violent man. He offered the gun back to Bobby, saying he didn't want any trouble and that they should take it and leave. Knowing they couldn't possibly return to Charlie empty-handed, Susan and Mary were told to watch Gary while Bobby went to call Charlie. When he arrived an hour later, he brought a sword with him and used it to slash the right side of Gary's face. As Gary writhed about in agony, Charlie asked the others to make him comfortable but keep him prisoner until he gave up the money. By the third day of keeping him hostage, Bobby had had enough. After getting Gary to sign ownership of his car over to the group, Bobby stabbed him in the stomach, then smothered him to ensure he was dead. In a panic, the group tried to make it look as though the murder had been committed by political revolutionaries by writing "political piggy" on the wall in Gary's blood. By then, Charlie's group, often referred to now as the family, had become scattered between Spahn Ranch, Death Valley, and a house in Canoga Park known as the Yellow Submarine. When news of Gary's murder began filtering back to the mall, many were shocked and immediately ended their association with the group. Many of the others who chose to stay, like Susan, only became more and more convinced by Charlie's teachings. Helter Skelter was coming, and there was nothing any of them could do about it. Nor was there any reason to fear what was happening. Guilt, like everything else, was just an illusion. And when even you are an illusion, there is only one, and everything is part of it. On Friday, August 8th, 1969, LA was in the middle of an intense heat wave. Up at Sharon and Roman's home at 150 Cielo Drive, Sharon, by now 8 months pregnant, was overseeing the painting of what was to be her baby's nursery. At the time, Sharon was sharing the house with Abigail and Wojtek, who Roman had asked to stay on and watch out for her while he was away in London. After going for a swim in the morning, Sharon received a call from Roman, who'd been delayed coming back to LA, to let her know that he would be returning the following Tuesday. Around 5:30 that afternoon, Sharon's ex-boyfriend Jay left his home on Eastern Drive and arrived at Sharon's house a short time later. The pair had been due to attend a dinner party at Sharon's friend Sheila Wells' house that night, but when Sheila called about it that afternoon, Sharon, tired out from the heat, declined the invitation. Instead, when Abigail and Wojtek, having been out all day, returned home at 7, Jay suggested the four of them go to El Coyote for dinner, a trendy restaurant at the time, located on Beverly Boulevard. It had just gone 10 when the group arrived home, a little high and drunk, with the exception of the pregnant Sharon, and tired from the long hot day. As they approached the property, all was dark, save for a light by the side of the garage and those bright, colourful Christmas lights strung out across the front of the house. And then, the four of them made their way inside. Earlier that day, Susan was lounging around the boardwalk at Sparn Ranch when Charlie appeared. Calling for Linda, Pat, Tex, and Susan, he asked to speak to them individually. Susan watched as he spoke quietly to the others until finally he approached her. It was a simple request, to go with Tex and do whatever he did. The four of them, each carrying a knife and dressed all in black as per Charlie's request, piled into a beat-up Ford Galaxy where Susan noticed a rope and a pair of bolt cutters on the back seat. Asking Tex where they were heading, he replied, to Terry Melcher's house. And with that, they pulled out of the ranch and headed off on their way. After getting lost en route, the four finally arrived at the base of the steep private road that led toward the house. Turning into it, Tex then parked up close to an electricity pole and ordered the others out of the car. The women watched as he took the bolt cutters, climbed up the pole, and cut two wires that led out toward the house at the end of the drive. Ordering everyone back into the car, they then parked it at the bottom of the road before getting out and making their way barefoot toward the house. As they approached, Susan caught sight of a long line of Christmas lights stretched out across the front of the property and wondered for a moment what kind of people might live there. At the front gate, in case it was alarmed, Susan headed toward the fence just to the right, put her knife between her teeth, and shunted up over it, falling heavily into an ivy bush on the other side. Dusting herself down, she waited for the others, after which they all dropped to their hands and knees and had just begun crawling toward the house when a pair of lights flashed across the ground. A car was approaching. Tex told them to lie down and stay quiet, then disappeared into the night. Halt! The voice was Tex's and had come from somewhere out of the darkness in front of them. Then another voice was heard. Please don't hurt me. I won't say anything. Then there was a brief pause, followed by the sound of four gunshots. Tex returned a few moments later and told the others to follow him. As they neared the house, Susan could see the Rambler car now parked up in the middle of the drive and the young man slumped dead in the front seat. Tex reached in and turned off the lights, and together they quietly pushed the car off the driveway. Turning their attention back to the house, the group continued silently toward it. Arriving at a window, Tex opened it and crawled inside, telling the others to wait where they were. A moment later, hearing the front door open, they turned to see Tex standing there, ushering them inside. Susan and Pat stepped softly into the house, while Linda was told to wait outside. Continuing further in, the two women stopped suddenly at the sight of Tex standing over a couch on which a man was lying fast asleep. Just then, the man began to stir, stretched out his arms, and slowly opened his eyes. "What time is it?" he asked sleepily. Tex jumped in front of him and held out his gun. "Be quiet. Don't move or you're dead," he said. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" said the man, terrified. "I am the devil," replied Tex, "and I'm here to do the devil's business." If you enjoy Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now do so via Patreon. To receive access to ad-free episodes, discount on merchandise, as well as brand new video and audio content exclusive to Patreon members, just go to patreon.com/unexplainedpod to sign up. Or if you'd like to make a one-time donation, you can go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, featuring 10 stories that have never before been covered on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Waterstones, among other bookstores. All elements of Unexplained, including the show's music, are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.